Welcome to this podcast, where we will be speaking to two leading clinician researchers in neuromuscular medicine, Dr. James Howard Jr. from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and Dr. Nicholas Silvestri from the University of Buffalo. We know that myasthenia gravis is a complex disease and it carries significant disease burden. Dr. Silvestri, will you share a patient's story that highlights what a patient with severe disease faces on their patient journey?
Yeah, if I think about one of my more severe patients right now, it's a young man who we recently diagnosed with myasthenia gravis, who we also found to have a thymoma. And so not only was he dealing with a new diagnosis of myasthenia gravis, he was dealing with a diagnosis of thymoma. Although the thymoma was successfully removed, he still has persistent symptoms at this point in time. He has intermittent double vision, trouble swallowing, trouble chewing, trouble breathing, and generalized weakness. Unfortunately, this young man early in his course went into crisis several times, was hospitalized several times, and is just now starting to stabilize out. So, you know, he went from being a young, healthy, working full time to being repeatedly hospitalized, now on disability, and has a young child at home. So he and his wife are dealing not only with his disease and the burden of his disease and him being out of work, but also trying to care for their young child as well. So this has truly been a difficult case for me to handle.
Dr. Howard, please also share a patient story.
One of my most memorable patients was a middle-aged computer software engineer who developed significant double vision and ptosis such that he could not spend more than 15, 20 minutes programming at his computer. And as a result, was let go from his position. And very rapidly over the course of 3 months developed very severe generalized myasthenia involving abnormal speech, abnormal swallow. The latter got to the point where he ended up getting a feeding gastrostomy in order to sustain himself. His diagnostic odyssey was delayed about 6 months as he went from physician to physician trying to establish a diagnosis, and each time he was given some other diagnosis that didn't fit, was tried on some therapy that didn't work, and ultimately landed in a neurology clinic where the diagnosis of myasthenia gravis was made. His initial therapy included high doses of corticosteroids, with which he gained over 30 pounds. He developed very rapidly cutaneous thinning of his skin, so easy bruising. He was then switched to azathioprine, but because of the long delay for that drug to start working, he ended up in myasthenic crisis on a ventilator and then was transferred to the university where he was treated with plasma exchange and then other immune suppressive drugs and has slowly come back from that. So here's a middle-aged guy who loses his job because of his illness, develops complications of his therapy. So not only disease burden, but treatment burdens. And he's one that will stick in one's mind forever.
Thank you both for sharing those patient stories, one of which entailed an initial inaccurate diagnosis. Dr. Howard, what are the challenges to diagnosing generalized myasthenia gravis? And please outline the consequences of delayed or inaccurate diagnosis.
The odyssey of myasthenia gravis, while improved over the last decade, is not a short one. It's very long. And we have had patients, particularly women, who with a disease that fluctuates, may not have much of the way of symptoms earlier in the day. Some individuals call it the invisible disease, unless you have obvious drooping of an eyelid or widely separated eyes with double vision. And as such, it's not in the consciousness of the physician. In our medical school training and in our house staff training, we see very few myasthenic patients, unless you're fortunate to be at a myasthenia center. And so there are many physicians out there who have never seen a case of the disease. And unless one thinks about it, one doesn't, or one, if one doesn't understand it, one doesn't think about it. The vagaries of the symptoms, the fatigue, the fluctuations, the invisibleness of it often leads to not thinking and recognizing. It's like taking your car to the garage that's got a knock or a rattle. And when you get there, it doesn't do it. And the technician says, well, I don't know what's going on. It's no problem at the moment. And I think many of our patients feel the same way. I think the other big problem we face is a quote by Stephen Covey. And he says, the problem with communication is that we don't listen to understand, we listen to reply, meaning that while the patient is giving us their signs and symptoms, we're not assimilating this often. We're hearing what they say, but we're very rapidly coming to conclusions and getting ready to give the patient one's expertise, and we're not really digesting what's being told to us. Myasthenia is a diagnosis of history. It's a diagnosis of examination, and then only confirmed with laboratory studies. And if we short sheet the first two, we often don't come up with an early diagnosis. The importance is that there's now data coming out that suggests the earlier we treat, the more aggressive that we treat somebody, the better outcomes. And this has been shown in the multiple sclerosis world, where early aggressive disease-modifying therapy reduces the risk of morbidity over time. And I think the same holds true for many autoimmune disorders, such as MG.
Now moving on to treatment options. We know that immunosuppressants are often used. What are the benefits and challenges associated with their use to treat myasthenia gravis?
I think when it comes to the classic immunosuppressants, while effective in most patients, do come with a number of challenges. First and foremost, they take a long time to work. I think best case scenario is tacrolimus, which can take about 6 to 9 months to work. Mycophenolate probably takes about 12 months to work, and azathioprine all the way out to 18 months to work. And why that's important is in the meantime, patients are either suffering from persistent symptoms and or concomitant treatment with steroids to bridge them until these medicines are effective. And they obviously cause a lot of side effects, as was mentioned. I think another issue is really side effects on these medications, and those really occur in two phases, right? Short-term side effects and long-term side effects. So I think of the agent that I use most frequently, mycophenolate, can cause a lot of gastrointestinal side effects in patients, upset stomach, nausea, diarrhea, and really all of the agents long-term, because of their broad immunosuppressive actions, really put people at risk not only for infections, but also malignancy. And so I think that as we evolve the treatment paradigm over time, we have to think not only how effective are the agents at reducing disease burden, but we also have to think about treatment burden, again, both in the short and the long term. And are we really willing to put our patients at risk for long-term side effects with some of the classic immunosuppressants?
Thank you. You mentioned mycophenolate as your go-to agent when it comes to using an immunosuppressant, but there are numerous options. Tell us, more broadly, what are the key considerations clinicians should think about when it comes to selecting which particular immunosuppressant to prescribe?
Yeah, I think when it comes to choosing a particular immunosuppressant, there's a couple of factors that come into mind or come into play, rather. I think that patient comorbidities are one, so you want to make sure that you're not prescribing a medicine that may interact with another medication a patient's on or aggravate one of their diseases. But I think also because there's a couple of different options, we all tend to have our favorite that we use that we become most facile with. And are more prone to use. I, you know, kind of grew up and was trained with mycophenolate being the go-to. I think it's generally speaking well-tolerated, generally effective, and works a little bit faster than my number two, which would be azathioprine. So that's the rationale for choosing that over others. Again, that being said, I've got patients on all of these different medications. They all have their advantages and disadvantages. But I think that we as docs that treat myasthenia tend to pick one or two, become most comfortable with, and use that in general.
Dr. Howard, I see that you have additional commentary to share.
We often can get the drug paid for through assistance programs, government programs, but we have difficulty getting the ancillary testing necessary to monitor safety paid for. And many times, or sometimes, patients won't take the drug for fear that if they do, and have a side effect because they can't afford the CBC or the liver function studies, et cetera. Because of that fear, they don't take the drug. The other issue I see is compliance. And I'm very reluctant to use some of these cytotoxic therapies if the patient is non-compliant, particularly in getting the accessory laboratory studies done to monitor safety, and then we'll try and choose something else. But those are two additional things to what Dr. Silvestri talked about, which I fully agree with.
Thank you. Now, considering the neonatal Fc receptor inhibitors, Dr. Howard, how robust are the data supporting their use?
Neonatal Fc receptor inhibitors, FcRn, as we call them, are a new class of therapeutics available to treat myasthenia gravis. They're much like a chemical plasma exchange. IgG, immunoglobulin G, antibodies are recycled, and that's why they have a long half-life compared to other immunoglobulins like M, A, D, and E. And by inhibiting the neonatal Fc receptor, immunoglobulin G antibodies that are made of immunoglobulin G are taken into the cell, shunted to a lysosome, and destroyed. And so we effectively clear the body of circulating antibodies. And this has gained a foothold in treating myasthenia. And there are two currently available. One is efgartigimod, which is administered either by intravenous infusion or by subcutaneous injection, and rozanolixizumab, which is administered by subcutaneous infusion. Both do the same thing in reducing immunoglobulin G levels, antibody levels, and have been shown to be very effective in myasthenia gravis. The clinical trials, and I was a part of the efgartigimod trials, are administered in a cyclical fashion. So we treat for a specific period of time, weekly for 4 weeks for efgartigimod, over 6 weeks for ROSI, as we call it, because the name is too large to pronounce, and then monitor for clinical effect and then retreat when necessary. And so one can conceive of using this as an intermittent therapy based on patient preference, those who don't want to be treated continuously with a drug, much like we do with our other immune suppressants. One could use it as a bridge therapy. And so as Dr. Silvestri pointed out in one of his answers, that his patient took many months to start working, for that drug to start working, we can intervene with intravenous immunoglobulin plasma exchange, but now with an FcRn inhibitor, and tide them over till such time their oral immune suppressant is working. The side effect profiles of these FcRn inhibitors is very nominal, very narrow, and very well tolerated overall. And I think what will distinguish which of the ones we use will be patient choice, the physician's experience in using a particular compound. But clearly, this class of drugs will play a major role in our treatment of myasthenia, but also of other IgG-mediated autoimmune disorders, I think, in the future.
Thank you. Dr. Silvestri, back to you to comment about the complement inhibitors.
So we know that complement is involved in the pathogenesis of myasthenia gravis. We've known that for many decades. One of the ways in which the acetylcholine receptor antibody causes myasthenia gravis is by activating complement, and which leads to destruction of the neuromuscular junction. And so we've had complement inhibitors available to us since 2017, when eculizumab was approved on the basis of the positive results of the REGAIN trial, which demonstrated improvement in patients treated with acetylcholine receptor positive disease. And more recently, we've had ravulizumab approved, which is very similar to eculizumab, but has been slightly altered to have an extended half-life. So whereas eculizumab could be administered every 2 weeks, ravulizumab is administered every 8 weeks. Generally speaking, on the basis of the REGAIN trial, which was eculizumab, and the CHAMPION MG trial, which was ravulizumab, we know that these medications are effective in improving the symptoms of myasthenia gravis. That was shown in a more severe population in the REGAIN trial, and a more mild population in the CHAMPION-MG trial. And we also know that these medications are very safe. The key here is that patients need to be immunized prior to administration of these medications against Neisseria meningitidis, because blocking complement does put people at risk for an increased risk for infection for encapsulated bacteria, including Neisseria. But once you have a patient immunized, it reduces the likelihood of infection. And in fact, again, these medications are generally safe and well-tolerated. More recently, zilucoplan, which is subcutaneously administered, unlike eculizumab and ravulizumab, which are intravenously administered, was approved in the U.S., again, on the basis of positive results of the RAISE trial. So while we have a lot of experience using intravenous complement inhibitors in MG, we're just now able to prescribe a subcutaneous option as well.
Dr. Howard, you are a PI on the pivotal trial for zilucoplan. Can you comment on that agent?
With the approval of zilucoplan, a 15 amino acid macrocyclic peptide, not a full-size antibody, but a peptide, we now have a new choice for patients. First, it can be co-administered with plasma exchange and intravenous immunoglobulin, and there is no need, like with eculizumab and ravulizumab, for supplemental dosing. Additionally, because it can be stored at room temperature and it's in a pre-filled syringe, the patient now has the ability to travel and is not wedded to an infusion location or a hospital clinic or someone coming into the home to administer the drug. You pack your syringes in your suitcase and go. So for the family that's traveling, for the businessman, this is clearly an advantage.
Doctors Silvestri and Howard, what are the best practices for shared decision-making that clinicians should implement as they provide care for patients with myasthenia gravis?
So it's very important when treating patients with myasthenia gravis to listen to their symptoms, to listen to how their symptoms are impacting their daily lives, their livelihood, their interactions with others. We are very blessed to have multiple treatment options for patients with myasthenia gravis. And I think that when it comes to choosing which treatments are right for which patients, it really has to be a shared process. We have to have shared decision-making, taking patients' preferences into account, whether that has to do with route of administration, convenience issues, and really understanding, again, the impact that patient symptoms have on them and determining whether or not the therapies that they're on are effective, are leading to side effects. Because ultimately, what we want to be able to do in myasthenia gravis is to eliminate symptoms or have minimal symptoms and not at the expense of side effects. So we want patients to have minimal or no side effects on their therapy. And I think with listening to patients, involving them in the decision-making process, this is possible and has become more possible over time with the addition of new treatments and our armamentarium.
I couldn't agree more with what Dr. Silvestri has said. One needs to listen to understand, not simply to give back an answer. I think patients have to be their own advocate. I think it's important that at clinic visits, they bring someone with them, because one doesn't hear everything that is said to them. A lot of it is forgotten, and a second set of ears is critical. I also think it's important to come with pre-arranged questions that you have in rank order, if you will, of those that are important in case not all of them can be answered. We often forget all of the symptoms we're experiencing. And I have a colleague in Sardinia, Lady.myasthenia on Instagram, who has an MG bingo card. And she has patients or colleagues highlight those symptoms which are most important, and they bring that to clinic, and they find that very helpful. But from a physician perspective, we need to look at the whole patient. What's their mental health? I think it's an area that we have not paid a lot of attention to. If one's a cancer patient, one is immediately surrounded by social workers and a nursing team that will guide you through the process from cancer diagnosis to treatment. And I think for some, not all, but for some of our more severe patients, or where the societal impact is so large, we need to adopt a similar approach. And so it's thinking out of the box, but most critically, listening to what the patient tells you.
Dr. Howard, are there recommended resources that both clinicians and patients and their caregivers should connect with for education, support, and advocacy.
There are multiple resources available to the patient with myasthenia gravis. I think first and foremost, and my go-to, is the Myasthenia Gravis Foundation of America website that has educational material. It has the latest and greatest in terms of research that is going on, has a list of those experts in myasthenia around the country, as well as support groups, which for some patients are a very critical need. The other organization that can be quite helpful is the Muscular Dystrophy Association. And they're scattered throughout the world, in the US, of course. And then there's NORD, the Rare Disease Network, that has invaluable material for patients who have a rare disease like MG. And so using Google or Bing, one can find these, link to it, and then reach out to the patient advocacy groups of MGFA, of MDA, and they can be of much help to you.